Welcome to Research at Texas A&M. The following podcast, The Time of Your Life, is part of the Texas A&M Institute for Advanced Study Faculty Fellows Lecture Series. Dr. J.C. Dunlap holds the Nathan Smith Chair in the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. As a 2012-2013 TIOS Faculty Fellow, Dr. Dunlap has been closely affiliated with Texas A&M's world-renowned Center for Biological Clocks Research, as well as the Program for the Biology of Filamentous Fungus in the College of Science.
Well, it's nice to be here. It's an honor and a privilege to be the first speaker in the series for the Texas A&M University Institute for Advanced Studies. I'm delighted to be here, and I've been very pleased with the welcome I've gotten so far. It's often a little hard to hit on public lectures. You don't quite know who's going to be out there. So we'll see. But I have taken pleasure and comfort in the certainty that for all of you, this will be the best of the series that you have heard so far. So I've pitched this like a Scientific American or a Nova series, which doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to hit everything on what I do. So what Nova would do is they would start with people, because that's what everybody's interested in, right? So people and jet lag. Nearly all of us have done jet lag. And the phenomenon is this. Your body is here, and your brain is here in College Station, all right? So it's easy to say, but now get your arms around this and think about it. There you are in London. You've been there for 2 days. You're eating British food. You're drinking British beer. You're breathing British air. You're in British sunlight. You are completely immersed in that hemisphere, but your body is still where it came from. And that really says it all. None of these acute effects, the food, the alcohol, the sunlight, the air, anything, really has a profound effect on your physiology. It's your circadian clock that is calling the shots, and it is telling the whole system what time of day it is. And that really puts clocks where they are. They are at the top of the heap for determining physiology, and that's why this is an interesting problem. So this is shamelessly purloined from Deb Bell Peterson's website. Our entire physiology is profoundly cyclical. So homeostasis in the canon sense of the word really means rhythmicity. Things are not flat, they are rhythmic, and they have appropriate times of day for when things are supposed to peak. So running through the day here, deepest sleep, lowest body temperature. Around here you start waking up. Most people wake up between 6 and 8 in the morning, about 2/3 of us. Highest alertness, too bad. Noon, best coordination. So this is when marathons finish. It's when you have the highest endurance, blood pressure, and so on. So literally from birth. So most moms go into labor here, give birth here, to death. Peaks in heart attacks. 2/3 of heart attacks happen between 8 and 10 in the morning. So the good news is that the senior faculty have made it another day. Profoundly rhythmic. So how does this work? So sunlight is perceived by the eyes, and that makes a neuronal signal which goes back through the optic tract, back to the optic chiasm, and up into two bundles of neurons that sit on top of the optic chiasm called the suprachiasmatic nuclei. They're there. And that's a dominant pacemaker. It sends out time cues to the rest of the body, to these peripheral clocks, and there are peripheral clocks all over. And they dictate the time in that particular tissue. So looking at the wiring diagram at the bottom here, light goes into the eye, it makes a neuronal signal, which goes to the SCN, which is the pacemaker. It sends cues out to the periphery, the CNS, pituitary, pineal, liver, kidney, lung, skeletal muscle, whatever. And those particular tissues then drive the various overt circadian rhythms that we all experience. So what are some of these? So sleep is a major one. But it's an interesting case study. So with sleep, there are two processes controlling when we get sleepy. One is the circadian, and one is the homeostatic, or the sleepy gas. So sleepy gas works like a relaxation oscillator for the, where are the physicists in here? I'm just talking to one. There you are. So when you stay up, sleepy gas accumulates. Metaphorically. And the longer you're awake, the more sleepy gas accumulates. And the only way to get rid of sleepy gas is to go to sleep. So you get sleepier and sleepier the longer you stay up. But superimposed on that is the circadian sleep urge. So this, if you will, is the perception of how much sleepy gas there is. And this we have all experienced. You stay up all night, 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, you're really tired. 9 in the morning, you're not so bad. 10 in the morning, you actually feel pretty good. And you can get through the rest of the day without any trouble at all. And that's not because you've dissipated any sleepy gas, but it's because that's the circadian component, the perception of how tired you are kicking in and superimposing. So so these two processes together, this relaxation oscillator and the circadian oscillator, together determine how sleepy you are. If you miss sleep, the homeostatic drive for sleep increases, and that produces a sleep debt, which has to be paid back at some point. And sleep debt is a real thing. So it signals, one of the things it signals is a need to overeat, and that can lead to obesity. So this is an experiment, citations are here, following leptin. Leptin is produced when you eat, and it signals to your brain, your body, that you've had enough to eat. Okay, so if leptin levels are normal, when you eat a meal, you're full. If leptin levels are low, you eat a meal, you're not full, and you want to keep eating. All right, so if you're in sleep debt, short night, leptin levels are much lower than they are if you've had a long sleep. So the difference here corresponds to a leptin signal that would be seen if you went 3 days eating in total 3,000 calories less than you're used to eating. So this is like, you know, a Big Mac a day from sleep debt, not from overeating. So it's a real thing. The circadian clock controls toll-like. So let's translate this. Here. The time of day when mice are vaccinated affects the response. So we all get vaccinated, right? I had my flu shot. When you get vaccinated, two things happen. One is that the immune, right, there's humoral immunity and there's cellular immunity. One of the things that's supposed to happen is that you goose the immune cells so that they divide, so that there are a lot more immune cells there that can react to whatever it is that you're being immunized against. And you can see here that depending on what time of day, afternoon or early morning, you are immunized, it's much better to be immunized very early in the morning. You'll get a much greater immune response. The other thing that happens with the immune system when you get immunized is that the whole system gets goosed, and the cells talk to other cells, and the whole system gets charged up and gets ready to respond. That's this part over here, immune system activation. And depending on afternoon versus early morning, when you are immunized, the response is much stronger in the early morning. So this is in mice with lights on at 7, off at 7 p.m. So something very similar to that presumably happens in people. So it's a real thing. Some of the pathophysiology. In mice, loss of the clock in the pancreas leads to diabetes. So here's the experiment. I should have pointed this out right there. A normal mouse has a clock in the pancreas. These mice were genetically engineered so that during the course of growth, after they were born, the clock in the pancreas was ablated. So the pancreas is still there, it's just not keeping time anymore. All the other tissues are keeping time, the SCN is keeping time. Mouse is rhythmic, sleeps at the normal time of day, just doesn't have a clock in the pancreas. Many of you will have had glucose tolerance tests for diabetes. So the concept here is you give the patient, or in this case the mouse, a bolus of glucose. If the pancreas is working right, insulin's supposed to go up, and that keeps blood glucose down. If you're diabetic, insulin isn't produced sufficiently, blood glucose stays high. All right, so you can see that's what's happening to these poor mice. Give them a slug of glucose here. In the controls, there's a modest increase, and then it goes down like it's supposed to. in the mice without a clock in their pancreas, still have a pancreas, still have islet cells, still make insulin. In fact, they make just as much insulin as the knockout mice. It's just not clock regulated. And that's a real diabetic response. Same with insulin. It goes up after glucose in the controls. In the clock knockout, it doesn't. So this is just the absence of being able to coordinate metabolism in the pancreas. Pathophysiology of sleep, again. So we talked about this. Circadian, homeostatic, normal sleep. You're awake during the day, and you sleep at night, early night. All right. So what happens if the clock runs with a short period length? So there's a variant where the clock doesn't run with a full day, but runs with a short day. All right. So what that would do would be to push this circadian curve over and would tend to make people sleep earlier. All right. So that's this, familial advanced sleep phase syndrome. And there are people with this, and they are due to genetic variants in the PER2 gene, a serine to glycine change, or in a kinase, CK1, a threonine to alanine change. And the result of this is that the period length of the clock is short, and sleep onset occurs much earlier than it would otherwise. So this is more than a curiosity. You can imagine being a teenager with this, where you would have no social life. If your body wants to go to sleep at 7 o'clock, in the same way that a normal teenager wants to go to sleep at midnight or 2, and in fact that's how this was first detected. It wasn't the kids; it was the grandmother that presented at the doc and said, "Can you do something for my grandchildren?" Here's the other end of the spectrum. Different genetic variants in different genes causing a delayed sleep phase syndrome. But it's a clock problem. Single amino acid changes in single proteins with this absolutely profound behavioral consequence. So we're talking about circadian rhythms, and it's a good time for a definition. These are free-running sustainable oscillations with an approximately 24-hour period length, circa DN, approximately 24 hours, universally associated with light and temperature perception. They can be entrained to environmental cues so that the internal time corresponds to external time. The clock operates within, physiological limits. And the period length of the rhythm is compensated against changes in temperature and metabolic state. That's a phenomenon known as temperature compensation. For instance here, this is daily incidence of sleep and wakefulness in an infant during the first half year of life. Black bars indicate sleep, white bars indicate wakefulness. So up here, a little Murgatroyd emerges. And I don't know how many of you are parents. This is those of us that are have done this. Baby sleeps and wakes based on how full the tummy is, or it has nothing to do with light dark cycle, at least. And so it's very difficult for parents to get any sleep during this period. Right around here, around 8 or 9 weeks in this child, you can see that there is some nucleation of sleep and wake. So sleep is being coordinated one part of a day and wakefulness to another part, but the period length of that change between sleep and wakefulness is not 24 hours. It's clearly longer than 24 hours because it's processing across time. So what's happened here is that the cell biology and the intercell biology of the clock developmentally has come together. So the clock is running in the brain and in the peripheral tissues, but the neuronal connections from the eye to the clock back here are not made yet. So the clock is running, but it can't be entrained. Sometime around here, 14 to 16 weeks, the neuronal connections from the eye to the clock are established. Baby gets the cues, starts to sleep, and parents get to sleep, and life goes on. So, arrhythmicity, free running, and entrained. So clocks like this are found not just in people, of course, but all over biology. So this is an unrooted tree of life with the three great assemblages of organisms, archaebacteria, eubacteria, and eukaryotes. Groups in blue are where clocks have been described, and in red are organisms that people have worked on. So clocks are found in all three groups, in archaebacteria and halobacterium, and eubacteria only within the cyanobacteria, and people study Senecococcus. In eukaryotes, they're found sporadically in the protists and universally here in this group. These are the crown eukaryotes. These all emerged after the Cambrian explosion about 1 or 1.2 billion years ago. These are organisms that we're all familiar with, higher plants, animals, fungi. We know how clocks work from basic research on Neurospora and on Drosophila primarily, and the clocks work in similar ways in these two organisms, and so by analogy we now also know a lot about how clocks work in mice and in humans. There's also a lot of good work going on in higher plants in Arabidopsis and Chlamydomonas. So with a phenomenon this universal, there must be some, it must be doing something for the organism. So I have a few slides on what it does. So clocks are useful. They allow anticipation and they promote coordination. So one aspect of this is programming for appropriate things to happen at appropriate times of the day. So this is a vineyard in the south of France, and those grapes are furiously fixing carbon in order to make grape juice. So this is photosynthesis. So what we plotted here is carbon assimilation or stomatoconductance. And the kicker is here, under constant moderate light and constant CO2. So there's no external rhythmicity here. This is an experiment done under constant conditions. And even though the environment is constant, the plants are fixing carbon rhythmically. Fixing it very well, more carbon fixed per photon in the middle of the day than at night. Likewise, stomatal conductance. Stomata are the little holes in the bottom of the leaves that allow air exchange, CO2 in, oxygen out. So those are open during the day, they're closed at night, all driven by the circadian clock. So here's another example, bioluminescence. If you're a small organism living in the ocean, it makes no sense to make light during the day because no one will see you anyway. And so they don't. They make light at night. So graphed here is, this is the amount of light produced by a culture of these organisms as a function of time, days, in constant dim light, constant temperature. And you can see it's again, profoundly rhythmic. These are the organisms doing this. They're dinoflagellates. This is about 40 microns across from here to here. Here are a couple of them. So very small, single cells, and yet they're keeping time. So no matter whether the cells are very small or the organism is very large, circadian system is coordinating the physiology. This is Robert Wadlow, the tallest documented human. He lived to be 22, and by all accounts, he was looks just like he looks. He's a very nice guy, and people really liked him. I was talking to someone about height and families. So this is Dad, this is Mom, and these are his sibs. Programming. So another use of clocks is for photoperiodism. Photoperiodism is the ability of plants and animals to control development or behavior based on length of night versus length of day. So Cal and Coe, if the day is short and the night is long, you get these nice flowers. If the day is long and the night is short, there are no flowers. And it's not just Cal and Coe, it's aloe and camellia and poinsettia, Thanksgiving cactus, Christmas cactus, and a whole host of other plants are cueing their ability to develop based on length of day versus, is that me? Length of night. It's an earthquake, isn't it? Another example, diapausan insects. A diapause is like hibernation for an insect. And you can see there's a very sharp boundary here in critical day length, about 14 hours. Short days, they make cocoons for overwintering. Long days, they grow into a moth. Another use, celestial navigation. So this is the monarch butterfly. Starlings and racing pigeons do something very similar. They use a time-compensated sun compass, and that's explained here. If you're a monarch butterfly and you're flying south and you want to stay on south, you know in the morning the sun has to be to your left because it's in the east. In the middle of the day, the sun ought to be right in front of you if you're flying from North America down to Mexico. And in the afternoon, the sun ought to be off to your right because that's the west. So the sun is processing over the horizon, and the butterfly is using the time-compensated sun compass to stay on due south. And in fact, if you take a butterfly into the lab, and this has been done in the Repert lab, reset its clock and release it, it will consult its own internal clock, look to see where the sun is, and fly off in the wrong direction until the natural light dark cycle resets its clock and it can come back in again. So with such a useful biological phenomenon, it makes sense that people would have discovered this many years ago. And in fact, they did. The first known example in the literature is from Androsthenes. He was marching with Alexander the Great across the Middle East, and he observed daily leaf movements in the tamarind tree that's shown here. So these little petioles will close up at night and open up during the day. Legumes all do this. He told Theophrastus, the father of botany, so this was well known in the ancients. So this was Greece. They passed it on to Rome. It was well known to Pliny and in that literature, and known sporadically through the Middle Ages. It was also part of the vernacular. The tragical history of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. You will immediately see who this is. This is Blake's rendition of the ghost of Hamlet's father. And I will. So your job is to find the reference to circadian rhythms. Thus was I, sleeping, by a brother's hand of life, of crown, of queen, at once dispatched, cut off even in the blossoms of my sin, unhouseled, disappointed, unannaled, no reckoning made, but sent to my account with all my imperfections on my head. Oh, horrible, most horrible. If thou hast nature in thee, bear it not. Let not the royal bed of Denmark be a couch for luxury and damned incest. But howsoever thou pursuest this act, taint not thy mind, nor let thy soul contrive against thy mother aught. Leave her to heaven and to those thorns that in her bosom lodge to prick and sting her. Fare thee well at once. The glowworm shows the matin to be near and gins to pale his ineffectual fire. Adieu, adieu, Hamlet, remember me. So where is the reference to circadian rhythms? The glowworm shows the matin to be near and gins to pale his ineffectual fire. Right, the glowworm has no idea when it's morning. The sun has not come up. The glowworm, of course, is bioluminescent. If you're a worm, it makes no sense to make light during the day. So the glowworm is anticipating daytime using his or her biological clock to gin to pale his or her ineffectual fire. So Shakespeare knew about clocks. The first case in the scientific literature, 1729. This is L'Histoire de l'Académie, published 1729. This is Louis the Dauphin. He never became king. Probably a good thing for him. He was born in 1729. This was, ostensibly published in 1729, but it wasn't really published until 1733. So at this point, Louis is 4 years old, so he can make it onto the frontispiece. Page 47. Here's the article, Observation Botanique. So reading from the beginning, on fait que It is known that the sensitive plant is heliotropic. So this is 1729. This is before Linnaeus, so there's no binomial nomenclature. So this is Mimosa pudica, but it's not called Mimosa pudica because Mimosa pudica didn't exist. It was simply the sensitive plant. That's the plant that when you touch the leaves, they move. Okay, so he's got Mimosa pudica here. It is known that the sensitive plant is heliotropic, which is to say that the branches and leaves always direct themselves to the side from which comes the light. And he goes on to comment on this, and then here. Monsieur de Marin has observed that it's not necessary for this phenomenon that they be in the sun or even in open air, but only, it's only a little less marked when one keeps it closed up in a dark place. It still opens up very noticeably during the day and folds up regularly in the evening for the whole night, pour toute la nuit. And the next page here. So he talks some about the how it's interesting that the plant can sense the sun without actually seeing the sun. And he makes the connection then, it's probably very similar to the interesting ability that patients in hospitals have to know what time of day it is when they can't see the sun. Because of course this was when hospitals, when the belief was that in a hospital you should be closed up completely out of the sunlight and out of the air. So the doors and windows were always closed in hospitals, but sick people continued to know what time of day it was. And then at the end here, this is, again, wonderful. But the ordinary occupation of Monsieur de Marin does not permit him to pursue these experiments just yet. And he forbears with a simple invitation to botanists and physicians who themselves also have other things to pursue. And that is that la marche de la véritable physique, the progress of true physics, which is experimental, is extremely slow. So this was 1729. In his lifetime, a few years later, I don't know if Linnaeus read or was spoken to about this, but Linnaeus knew about clocks, actually published a book about Somnus Plantarum, the sleep of the plants. This is Linnaeus as a younger man after a trip to Lapland dressed up in, as a Lap, and this is after his ennoblement. He's no longer Carl Nielsen Linnaeus, but Carl von Linné. He recognized three kinds of plants. The Meteorici, three kinds of flowering plants. The Meteorici, where the flowers would open or close depending on weather conditions. The Tropici, where flowers would open and close depending on length of night versus length of day. So these are the photoperiodic plants. And the Equinoctales, and these were the flowers that would open and close based on time of day. So based on that, he put together the first flower clock. This is his flower clock, different flowers opening at different times of day. And here it is. So the phenomenon was well known now by mid-1700s, and it continued to be well known. It was by 1800, early 1800s, this was mainstream science, particularly in Europe. This was an object of major study by the principal scientists of the time, particularly in Germany, which was the seat of botany and of plant physiology. Sachs and Pfeffer were the dominant scientific figures, and they both worked on circadian rhythms. Sachs in the mid part of the century, Pfeffer at the end of the 1900s and end of the 20th century. And I think there's no doubt in my mind that the problem would have been solved in Germany first and in plants first if it had not been for the First and Second World War that completely terminated that entire line of research. The problem was picked up again in the U.S. In the mid to late 50s through the 60s. By the mid-60s, the question of biological rhythmicity had been broken down into manageable parts, and they are here. One question, one part of the problem is the oscillator. So there is an oscillator. It's autonomous, it's self-sustained, and it's endogenous. Another set of questions is around input. How does an internal oscillator get in sync with the external environment? And the third part of the question is output. Once you have an entrainable oscillator, how does it direct the rhythmic biology and physiology of the organism? So these are the three big questions in chronobiology. How does input work? What is input? How is it perceived? And how is it transduced to the oscillator? The oscillator, what are the gears and cogs? How is it assembled? How does it work to keep time? And output. What are the aspects of output, and how is the connection made from the oscillator to make output work? It will come as no surprise to any of you that this is being solved in the same way that every problem in the life sciences is being solved. Through the application of genetics and physiology to frame the problem, application of molecular genetics to reduce it to manageable parts, and then biochemistry and cell biology to crack the nuts. So back to here, circadian systems. One of the first fruits of this was this observation. All circadian oscillators are based on regulation that is cell autonomous. That is, cells don't have to talk to other cells to make a clock. So this is a terrific piece of information. So what it does is it reduces all of this rococo biology that I've been talking about. It makes it a problem in cell biology. Instantly amenable to genetics and molecular genetics. Which is really, pretty neat. So clocks have been solved in three systems. Three kinds of clocks have been solved now, and I'm going to start to finish up with that. Eubacteria, plants, and fungi and animals. And I'll try to run through at a 40,000-foot view how they work. Senecococcus is a cyanobacterium. It is a self-sustained post-translational oscillator embedded within a transcription-translation feedback loop, which is not nearly as complicated as it sounds. So you recall the central dogma here. We're doing all right. Central dogma. So, Crick coined this phrase, central dogma, because in the early days of molecular biology, it was actually before RNA had been described, and they figured they knew how it worked, and so he came up with this, the central dogma, that DNA makes RNA, RNA encodes protein, and he called it the central dogma because he had been raised as an Anglican, and he said, I know what a dogma is. A dogma is what every true believer believes, but for which there is not a shred of real evidence. So the central dogma, DNA, through a process called transcription, is copied into RNA. RNA, in a process called translation, encodes protein. Proteins can be modified to slightly change their behavior. So the cyanobacterial clock starts up here, Chi-C. Chi-C is a protein made from a gene, Chi-C. And Chi-C forms a hexamer, six different copies of itself in a big ring. All right. And that Chi-C ring is bound by another protein, Chi-A. So when the other protein binds, Chi-C sort of shrugs, and that makes it phosphorylate itself. So that's a protein modification, just puts a phosphate on the protein. And that changes the protein conformation a little bit more so it can do it again. So I've populated these phosphates here, puts on a second phosphate. So now there are two phosphates, and Chi-C sort of shrugs more, and that makes it interact with another protein, Chi-B. So now Chi-B and Chi-A are both interacting with this hexamer of Chi-C. Chi-B causes this autophosphorylation to stop. So it stops, and phosphates start coming off. First one, then the second one. Now Chi-C has lost both of its phosphates, so it feels a little bit differently. It shrugs again, and Chi-A and Chi-B come off. And that, of course, regenerates what you started with. So this is the cycle in cyanobacteria. Just three proteins with phosphorylations that slightly torque the shape of the protein, causing protein-protein interactions to change. And that's a self-sustained feedback loop, and that's actually a circadian oscillator. Something about one of these forms also drives changes in the bacterial chromosome, so that it affects the expression of the genes in the chi cluster. So sometimes a day there's more chi A, chi B, chi C made, and other times there is less. So there's this protein post-translational oscillator, and there's also a transcription translation oscillator, both of those working at the same time. This is a system beautifully dissected by Takao Kondo at Nagoya, Susan Golden working at Texas A&M, and Carl Johnson working at Vanderbilt. So I want to come back here to the central dogma. DNA encodes RNA, RNA is translated into protein. So that suggests a model for a feedback oscillator. The DNA is a clock gene, and the protein is a clock protein, the clock protein might feedback and negatively feedback and block the expression of the gene encoding itself. And then if this protein turns over, or if there's a lag somehow in this, that would be sufficient to have an oscillator. A negative feedback loop with delays is an oscillator. People that design assembly lines in factories know all about this. If you're assembling widgets and cogs to make sprockets, and two assembly lines coming to meet at the sprocket assembly point, it's very difficult to design it so that you don't end up with too many cogs and too many widgets. Because if you send a signal back to the beginning of the line to slow down a production of one, by the time it gets back to the beginning and that reduced production comes forward, then there will not be enough widgets and there'll be too many cogs. So this negative feedback loop with delays really does give rise to oscillations. All right. With that context, looking at the higher Planck clock. Now this really does look like a hairball, but again it's dissectable. There are three loops here, three major loops and an ancillary loop. Well, let's start with loop A. There are two genes, CCA1 and LHY. They make proteins. CCA1 and LHY act together to negatively regulate another gene called TOC1. TOC1 makes a protein. It activates another gene, X, which makes a protein, and X turns on LHY and CCA1. So that is a negative feedback loop with delays. So it's an oscillator. And you can see that CCA1 and LHY not only interact with or regulate TOC1, but they also regulate here PRR7 and 9, and here GI. So these three independent or quasi-independent feedback loops are all interconnected. And depending on time of day, daytime, nighttime, one or the other loop will predominate, but they are all interconnected and all running at the same time. This has been beautifully dissected by Elaine Tobin, who identified the first clock gene in plants, Steve Kay, who identified the second one, TOC1, George Coupland, Andrew Millar, Rob McClung, and others. All right, on to the fungi and animals. So again, all circadian oscillators, including those in animals and fungi, are based on feedback loops that close within cells. So I have here a fibroblast, a liver cell, cardiac myocyte, a CNS neuron, and neurospora. And all these systems, the clock works like this. There are positive elements that drive expression of genes. The genes encode negative elements. Negative elements feedback, physically interact with the positive elements and turn down their activity. So that's a negative feedback loop with delays, and so it's an oscillator. Output can work this way. The positive elements driving expression of genes whose products don't participate in the core loop. And so that provides means for rhythmic metabolism and output. So here are some examples of this. Here's the core loop. Positive elements driving clock genes, making negative elements, blocking activity. Output here, either directly as structural genes or to regulate slave oscillators, giving rise to rhythmic biochemistry. So some examples of positive elements in neurospora, white collar 1 and white collar 2, two proteins. Cyclin clock in flies and Drosophila, B-mal and clock in mammals. White collar one and white collar two are two proteins that interact by a domain called a PAS domain. It's a particular sequence of amino acids that allows it to recognize and interact with another protein that has a similar sequence of amino acids. Clock and cycle, two different proteins to make a heterodimer interact by PAS domains. And BMAL and clock, two different proteins that make a heterodimer by interacting by PAS domains. And there's sequence similarity beyond that between these three, in particular between white collar and BMAL. The negative elements in Neurospora frequency and FRH, in Drosophila period and timeless, in mammals, two different period genes, period 1 and 2, and two cryptochromes, CRY1 and CRY2. There's no similarity at all between frequency and FRH in any of these. A lot of similarity between Drosophila pur and mammalian pur. Timeless in Drosophila doesn't have a role in flies, in the clock. Cryptochrome in mammals doesn't have a role in the fly clock. But there's a lot of similarity here. So overall, there's some similarities and some differences. But what is striking to me is the architecture of the feedback loops. So here is Drosophila and Neurospora in mammals. So again, here's the heterodimer, white collar 1, white collar 2, driving expression of frequency, making a heterodimer, feeding back in flies. Clock and cycle, driving pur and tim, making a heterodimer, feeding back. Here in animals, or mammals, cry and purr, making heterodimer and feeding back. So there are a number of other things being regulated, but it's only the pieces of regulation and the proteins that are inside the box here, as it were, that are essential for rhythmicity. If these proteins are lost, the system is arrhythmic. If these interactions are lost, the clock may not work quite so well, but it works. So it's really this central core feedback loop of transcriptional activation and repression that drives the clock. These are the folks that have dissected these. In Drosophila, Jeff Hall, Mike Young, Michael Rosbash, your very own Paul Harden, Isaac Ettery, and Amita Segal, and others, but I think these are the people that have done the heavy lifting. In Neurospora, my lab and my colleague, Jennifer Loros, also Eliu, Deb Bell-Peterson from here at Texas A&M, and recently Michael Bruner. And in mammals, Joe Takahashi, Steve Reppert, Chuck Weitz, Mick Hastings, Uli Schibler, Paolo Sassone-Corsi, which needs another S here, I see, and Toshi Okamura, and others. And there's been a lot of cross-pollination between all of these people. So one of the nice things about working in this field is that particularly in the fungal slash animal slash mammal field, there's been a lot of cross-pollination and interest in mutual interest in the work. And I think it's made it go very fast. I'm going to now bear down on Neurospora for the closing minutes. So how does the Neurospora clock work? White collar 1 and white collar 2, this heterodimer, binds to two different places on the frequency gene. It drives expression of RNA. The RNA goes into the cytoplasm and is translated into frequency protein, which dimerizes and interacts with FRH. It takes kinases into the nucleus, which phosphorylate white collar 1, turning off white collar 1. About this time, white collar 2 disappears from the promoter. Freak is phosphorylated in the cytoplasm. That makes it modifiable by a protein, FWD. The modified protein goes to the proteasome, which is the garbage disposal in the cell, and there freak is chewed up. About this time, white collar 2 reappears, and that cycle repeats about every 22 and a half hours. So that's the Cliff Notes version of how the clock works in Neurospora. So a feedback loop like this, like the kind we've been talking about, must result in cyclical expression of the negative element. And in fact, in all cases, it does. So if you look in Neurospora, looking at expression of frequency as a function of time, this is using a luciferase reporter, you can see it's cycling along very nicely. And simply this information that there is a feedback loop like this in rhythmic expression allows you to understand how clock resetting works. If light acts to induce this gene so that there's more expression, you will get resetting. You can see that here. If the organism sees light here, RNA or gene expression will be increased from the low point immediately to the high point. So that will advance the clock to that high point. If the organism sees light here, RNA levels will go from this lower point up to the peak, and that will immediately set the clock back there. So depending on the time of day at which the organism sees light, you will get advances or delays, and that will reset the clock. And it's really that simple. In a mouse brain, or in your brain, as it were. This is MPIR1, so this is one of the clock genes. The expression of MPIR1 in the brain clock is regulated by light and time of day and location. So in the subjective morning, expression is high, just like frequency is high in neurospora in the morning. In the subjective evening, expression is low, just like in neurospora in the evening, expression is low. If the mouse sees light in the night, expression is increased. All right, so light is perceived in the eye in retinal ganglion cells, and that's the chromophore that sees the light. It makes a neuronal impulse, which goes along the retinohypothalamic tract back to the SCN. Neurotransmitters are released, glutamate and PACAP. That results in calcium release within SCN neurons. That results in phosphorylation of a transcription factor, a protein called Krebs, which results in PIR1 induction. So when you fly from here to Paris, or you fly from here to Hawaii, this is what happens. PIR1 is induced right away. Your SCN clock is reset right away. Your SCN clock has no jet lag. And the problem is all in these pesky peripheral oscillators, which can take days and days and days to reset. Okay. So in all these systems, circadian changes are driven by dynamic phase-specific changes among a constellation of proteins. The positive limb, white collar 1 and white collar 2, driving freak. The negative limb, freak and FRH, repressing white collar. Input through light and output through clock-controlled genes. So output can be lots of things in neurospora. Sporulation, called conidiation. Pigmentation, stress responses, sexual development, membrane signaling, and intermediary metabolism. So this has set me up to say in three sentences what I'm going to do here. These are also driven by light. I want to work on clock mechanisms some using luciferase-tagged clock proteins, working with Paul Hardin and Mark Zoran to see where they are in the cell and what I can learn about the cell biology of these. I'm going to be looking at light and clock output research, studying how light and the clock regulate the biology of neurospora, doing this with Deb Bell-Peterson and Matt Sachs. This wants one more slide of explanation. So using those tools, chromatin immunoprecipitation, high-throughput DNA and RNA sequencing, and bioinformatics that we can do here, we're assembling the transcriptional regulatory network connecting light and the clock with output. So the transcriptional network will look something like this. We're starting to put together the pieces. And when we're done, we'll be able to understand how it is that neurospora can do this daily cycle in growth and development. So with that, thanks. And those of you that are still with it, I'd be happy to take questions.
This podcast has been brought to you by Texas A&M University's Division of Research. To learn more about the Texas A&M Institute of Advanced Study or listen to additional podcasts in this series, please visit tias.tamu.edu.